David Goldman, who envisioned this seminar, is the deputy editor of Asia Times, an economist, music critic, and author. He has written extensively on Rav Soloveitchik and Jewish philosophy for Chakira and other publications. His topic today is the Rav's incomplete grand design.
Thank you, Heshi. Thanks all of you for making it this far in the seminar. I know you're tired, so I'll be brief. Professor Kaplan's anecdote about the manuscript of Halakhic Bond is wonderful. You get to the last sentence, out of the sources of Halakha, new worldview awaits formulation. What's the next page? Well, in fact, we know exactly what the next page is, thanks to the efforts of Rabbi Treibitz, who is annotating and publishing Suryatim and Hakira, the Rav's 1947 lectures on Bereishit, which are an attempt to fuse several different fields, philosophy of mathematics, Jewish medieval philosophy, and Kabbalah, particularly Zohar, into a coherent Jewish philosophy. He did not do it. He changed his mind about many things. He dropped a number of avenues of investigation. And for 30 years, he spent a lot less time on the subject, in some ways dropped it entirely. Now, the question I think we should ask is, if we're talking about a Jewish philosophy, a new worldview, what's it good for? I mean, I'm a Baal Tshuva because I think Western philosophy failed. We have a Masorah that sustained the Jewish people for thousands of years. What do we need philosophy for? Let me offer you a paradoxical answer. We need a distinctly halakhic worldview in order to free ourselves from Gentile philosophy. Trotsky is supposed to have said, you may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you. I think this also applies to philosophy and the Jews. There are metaphysical issues that we can't avoid, starting with the question of time. Time orders Jewish practice, central concern of Rav Soloveitchik. Who can say what time is? That's not a trivial question. You tell me what time is, I'll buy you an excellent kosher dinner. For the Greeks, time is simply the measure of movement of heavenly bodies. It's absolute and unchanging. Now, what that means is that creation ex nihilo is inconceivable, because it means God sat around for an infinity of years, the unchanging God, and then one day he says, gee, let's create the world, have a partnership with man. What changed? It's a contradiction in terms. That's an old paradox. But I can tell you, if you believe in Newtonian or Aristotelian time, you're an apikoros, because you can't believe in a creator God. St. Augustine famously said, what is time? I have no idea. The past doesn't exist because it's gone. The future doesn't exist because it's not there yet. And the present vanishes in a moment too fleeting to perceive. So we don't know what it is. So let's go back to Kant, about a great deal, about whom a great deal has been said. Kant, as Rabbi Treibitz said, says perception is not simply the registering of perceptions on a blank slate, as in Aristotle, or Locke, or Hume. It requires the active participation of the observer to constitute experience. A great idea. So he said time and space are the two a priori forms of intuition, or inborn mental constructs without which we couldn't infer causality. Subjective understanding of time, Kant never tries to say what time actually is. That's part of the world in itself, which we don't know. Now, what's the problem with Kant? Kant says you have a three-dimensional Euclidean space and you have Newtonian time, Greek time. There are inborn forms of intuition. Then along come the mathematicians and say, gee, there are multidimensional spaces which are real. Einstein shows there's a four-dimensional space-time manifold which actually characterizes reality. So the whole apparatus of the Kantian theory crashes and burns. The details of Kant's theory are Gornstein. The Rav nonetheless thought there was something to the underlying idea, and possibly the greatest mathematician of the 20th century, Kurt Gödel, author of the incompleteness theorem, agreed. And what Gödel said is, okay, Kant says we've got this inborn Euclidean three-dimensional view of space. And we know that there are multidimensional spaces out there. We can map one onto the other. You can take every point in the sphere and through stereoscopic projection, find an identical corresponding point on a plane. For every n-dimensional space, you could do exactly the same thing. So Gödel says, even if we were born in a non-Euclidean world with many dimensions, we could nonetheless imagine space to be Euclidean, but we'd see material objects change their size and shape in a certain regular matter when they move with respect to us. So that's an interesting proposed solution. Now, that's good for space. What do you do about time, which is much more important to us? So if I may stretch an analogy, we might think of the mitzvot as the instruments by which we project the past and future, Matan Torah and Olam Haba, into the Jewish present. Time is not experienced passively. It is constituted by action directed by the ethical will. The reliving of the past and anticipation of the future enrich every moment of Jewish life with an infinite density of time experience. Augustine dismissed the moment as evanescent and as substantial. By contrast, the moment that is constituted by the mitzvot is infinitely rich with memory and expectation. The mitzvot fuse the past and future into the Jewish present. For the Christians, for Augustine, time is a paradox, eternity is an abstraction. To Jews, time is a construct of infinite richness. Now, just in passing, by the way, Gödel famously wrote a contribution to Albert Einstein's best, he was Einstein's best friend, and he showed that under certain circumstances, a rotating universe, you could, the equations of general relativity could make time go backwards. He wasn't proposing time travel. He was teasing Einstein. But Rosa Levechik in Halachic Mind talks about the reversibility of time and the causal order. He says it's fundamental in religion, for otherwise the principle of conversion would be sheer nonsense. The act of reconstructing past cycle life of changing the arrow of time from a forward to a retrospective direction is the main premise of penitence. Now, I'm not proposing that Soloveitchik's discussion of reversibility of the arrow of time and Gödel's are necessarily parallel to each other, but the point is that the frontier issues in mathematical physics, not the workaday view in the laboratory of incremental experimental work, but the ones that call up the paradoxes of creation itself, are of fundamental importance to us. Gödel says that the clock time of the Newtonian world is an illusion. We knew this. The psalmist said 3,000 years ago, for 1,000 years in your sight are but as yesterday when it has passed, and as a watch in the night. Kohelet says, I know that whatever God does shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God does it so that men should fear before him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already has been, and only God can find the pursuit. Jewish time is not an illusion. It's a sign to the world of God's intervention into human history. As Rosenzweig said, revelation is the first thing to set its mark firmly into the middle of time. Only after revelation do we have an immovable for, before, and after. So there's a great deal that Soloveitchik wrote about that. You probably read it, so I won't repeat it. It's important, I think it's fundamental to our health as a people and a community to be able to integrate these scientific issues into our concept of time. Rabbi Treibitz spoke learnedly and convincingly about the Rav and Husserl, but remember what the Rav's warning about Husserl in Halachic Mind. The Rav says it is no mere coincidence that the most celebrated philosophers of the Third Reich were outstanding disciples of Husserl. Husserl's intuitionism, which Husserl, a trained mathematician, strived to keep on the level of mathematical intuition, was transposed into emotional approaches to reality. When reason surrenders to dark, equivocal emotions, no dam in the world is able to stem this rising tide of the affective stream. The modern philosopher mystic is a disguised apostle of Dionysus. So what distinguishes the Rav's constitution of time from Heidegger? There are any number of articles saying the Rav really, you know, is a Heideggerian, which I think is a horrible idea and completely wrong. Heidegger works backwards from death. For Heidegger, time is nothing but the harbinger of death. The Ruf works forward from creation. And that's what you see in the 1947 Genesis lectures and his struggle to develop an idea of how singularity arises from the continuum. Clearly, he's quoting Hegel's Science of Logic, by the way, which in the view of the best modern mathematical historians anticipated many of the key advances in mathematical philosophy. That is something which I think the Ruf did not have the background to do single-handedly, and in fact, the most important mathematical work on these subjects was done after he did those lectures. In fact, the key work is from the 1960s by Kurt Gödel and Paul Cohen on the continuum hypothesis. So there is I think there's great opportunity in revisiting the issues which the Ruf mentioned in 1947, but was not really able to take forward by himself. What does this mean for us? Why is it important? In my view, and let me say something which I hope will provoke maybe even outrage, had the Ruf's project come to fruition, the Jewish world today would be different. The gap between the homo religiosus prone to mysticism and the dry rationalism of scientific investigation would be bridged. The mystical enthusiast would recognize the hand of God beckoning through the paradox of mathematical abstraction. The secular scientist also would confront the divine presence at the frontier of human reason. The creativity of majestic man, the inquiring scientist, would draw on the humility of covenantal man who trembles before the numinous presence of his creator. So what happened to the Ruf's project? Avraham Lichtenstein quotes the Ruf saying, "You know, I have devoted Talmidim, very devoted Talmidim. If I were to announce a shiur at 2 o'clock in the morning, they would come en bloc, and yet deep in their hearts, they think I'm an apikoros." In other words, he was too concerned with Gentile philosophy. That's part of the problem. I think what the Ruf said of the Rambam in his 1950 lectures at Yeshiva University, as edited by Professor Kaplan, is highly relevant. He says, there are two aspects to creativity in the realm of philosophy. The first is philosophical creativity, whereby one brings new thoughts to the totality of man's historical treasures. The second is creativity in the realm of philosophical style. Philosophical style refers to one's philosophical formula and terminology, choice of words, literary categories one employs. If one is both philosophically creative and as well creates a new philosophical style, he will revolutionize terminology. That could apply to the Ruf himself. He was a philosophical genius, but he was dependent throughout on the terminology of other philosophers. From Hegel in his discussion of dialectic, from the Neo-Kantians, from Kierkegaard, from Husserl, from Heidegger, occasionally Rudolf Otto, Berikson in his discussion of time. So this leads to huge amount of academic debates of attribution. Kantian, Hegelian, phenomenologist. My answer is none of the above are words of the living God. These are things for us to absorb and transcend in the creation of our own worldview. And where are the areas of further research? We need doctoral students who've got the chops in frontier issues in mathematical philosophy. We also need medievalists. The Ruf's search for a fusion between Zohar, medieval philosophy, particularly the critics of Aristotle among Jewish philosophers, and the mathematical issues are, I think, the right three prongs to attack. I've written elsewhere that Isaac Luria's concept of Tzimtzum offers a solution to the age-old paradox of the one and the many. That's Parmenides' argument that because everything really is one big glob, they're all change and all differentiation are merely an illusion. The concept of Tzimtzum in philosophy and mathematics is something which the Ruf emphasized, but it requires more investigation. For example, in set theory, which allows us to differentiate among mathematical entities. To have this differentiation, we have to exclude the set of all sets. Otherwise, we have paradox, which undermines the theory. I asked Professor Koppel, isn't this Tsum-Tsum? So engaging Western philosophy to emancipate ourselves from it is the task that the Rav left us. Western philosophy, in the modern era, is largely a German phenomenon. What good did it do them, ultimately? Reason is not enough. We need them a sword. The fact that Rav Soloveitchik was not able to complete his grand design doesn't imply that he was wrong to attempt. He bequeathed us an unfinished task. He envisioned a Judaism in which scientific understanding strengthened tradition and Torah insights inspired science, in which the duties of the heart and the obligations of the mind cleave together in the personality of the halachic man. We're not obliged to complete his work, but neither are we at liberty to neglect it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David Goldman.